VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, tensions continue to mount over the fatal police shooting of an unarmed Sacramento, California black man. The family of Stephon Clark joined hundreds of people at a rally over the weekend, urging California's capital city not to let his memory or calls for police reform fade nearly 2 weeks after the 22-year-old was killed by Sacramento officers. He was killed by two officers who were responding to a call of someone breaking into car windows. A day after the shooting, police distributed a news release that said the officers who shot Clark saw the suspect facing them advance toward them with his arms extended and holding an object in his hands. But a private autopsy released by the family showed Clark was shot multiple times in the back. Joining us now to talk about this is retired Los Angeles Police Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, who is also the author of the book Black and Blue. What exactly does this autopsy say about what possibly happened?
Well, it tells me what I knew initially upon seeing the camcorder information that was released from the officer's body cam, and that it should never have happened. This was a property-only crime. And listen, we don't even know if Stephon Clark was guilty of any breaking of car windows, of vandalism. We only know that he was suspected of that. And the fact that he ran does not automatically mean that he was the person responsible for those windows being broken. I don't know how many people I've had run for me in my 20 years of working patrol as an officer and a supervisor. And then when you catch them, you ask, what the heck did you run for? And they say, oh, you know, I didn't have a license, or I got a warrant and I didn't want you to know, and blah, blah, blah. So the fact that they would shoot him for such a minor indiscretion, if you will. Additionally, when we saw they had cover, they were on the side of the grandmother's home when they were engaging him and shouting orders to him. They could have maintained their position on the side of the house, a position of cover and concealment. They had the benefit of an air unit overhead, which was lighting up the area. They could have just freeze framed, wait till additional units are there to assist them in taking this person into custody. So to shoot 20 times is outrageous, excessive, unnecessary, and then to learn that he was hit 6 times in the back means that he was never a threat, never a threat. And so someone whose back is to you is certainly not a threat, not 20 bullets a threat. Officers are trained and taught, at least we are here in Los Angeles, fire 2 rounds in rapid succession and then reassess the threat. I would imagine that the training there in Sacramento is very similar. They certainly don't train you to empty out a magazine, which could be as many as 15 rounds before you reassess the threat.
So basically, why do you think that these officers reacted the way they did?
Well, you know, I can't get in their head, but I would just say that I believe that they were just caught up in the moment because, listen, I've been in foot pursuits and adrenaline is running. You're amped up. I get that. But then that's when your training should kick in. That's when common sense should kick in, because at the end of a foot pursuit, generally bad things happen. And then we see what I call people becoming a victim of contempt of cop. We see officers punishing the individual once they catch them because they had to run and they had to go over a fence and whatever else they had to do in pursuit of this person. And so just simply say, I thought he had a gun, or I thought I saw a gun, is unacceptable. We're not trained to think. Particularly when you're dealing with a deadly force situation, you need to know. You don't get a do-over if you get it wrong.
We are hearing about so many of these cases of young black men being shot by police officers. Do you think things are starting to shift now with people rising up and saying, this has to stop?
Well, the reason that I think it's happening is because there's no consequence. There's no accountability for police officers who shoot black and brown men unnecessarily outside of the policy of their department. There's no personal financial liability when that happens. Taxpayer pick up the burden of a civil suit in case there's one given to the family. So what does the officer learn? What has he been shown that would cause him to do anything differently the next time? Nothing. And so unless and until officers are held accountable for errant behavior, for out-of-policy shootings that result in a death or great bodily harm, then this is going to continue to happen.
We've been seeing quite a movement with these young people rising up against gun violence in general. And we heard several young African Americans coming out and saying, we are tired of seeing African Americans targeted.
We have examples, and these are just the things that we hear about. We have examples of Black men being shot and killed by police. Now, these are the things that make national news. There's so many other instances that don't end up in a death that we don't hear about. I had a mother reach out to me last. Her young son in Wheeler County, Georgia, savagely beaten by the sheriff deputies there. 16-year-old kid, Cameron Brockington, walking home a block or so away from home. Officers engage him, want to have a conversation with him, ask him for his ID, and he says, I've done nothing wrong, officer, but I live right up the street. And because he didn't produce his ID, they savagely beat this kid. We didn't hear about that. It's not making national news. But this is a thing that goes on. And so for the White House to say that this is a local problem is insulting and it's offensive. It's a national problem, but it's only happening to people who are Black and brown. So I would be left to think then that the White House doesn't care because it's not happening to little white kids. It's not a national issue. It's a Black issue. And so it's unimportant to the current administration in the White House. And as a mother of four Black sons, I find that offensive.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Retired Los Angeles Police Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey and author of the book Black and Blue. And finally, today we turn to the latest on social media with Doug Bernard. And Doug, I understand you're talking about the president's form of communication, Twitter, which he's been pretty busy with the past few days. What's the latest?
We've also often addressed President Trump's use of social media, particularly Twitter, really seems to be his favorite platform. And I think today what we might just do is take a look at this tweet storm that he went on Monday morning, just to explore how the president uses Twitter to make policy announcements. We know he's hired and fired people and that kind of thing. So let's just take a look at just a few of the policy pronouncements that he made in this tweet storm. A story that's been getting some attention, a owner of a number of local television stations, Sinclair Broadcasting, asked all of their news departments to read this pre-prepared kind of editorial. And while some on the left side of the equation have been, you know, calling it fake news itself, the president turned to that. He said, so funny to watch the fake news networks, among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever dealt with, criticize Sinclair Broadcasting for being biased. Sinclair is far superior to CNN and even more fake NBC, which is a total joke. He then again turns to his feud that he's having with Amazon, possibly in part because Amazon owner and founder Jeff Bezos also owns the Washington Post. The president tweets out, only fools or worse are saying that our money-losing post office makes money with Amazon. They lose a fortune. This will be changed. Also, our fully tax-paying retailers are losing stores all over the country. And then, if all of this were not enough, he turns his attention to the Department of Justice. So sad the Department of Justice and the FBI are slow walking or not even giving the unredacted documents requested by Congress, an embarrassment to our country. So six topics there over the course of about seven tweets, over the course of about 3 hours that he spent doing this. And it's just interesting to see how the president is really taken to Twitter as, I think, his kind of primary means of communication, it seems, and then just kind of leaves everybody else to debate amongst themselves what it is and pick up the pieces.
All right, that was Doug Bernard with our social media segment. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And you have been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. In an effort to limit resources that fuel the civil war in South Sudan, the United States Department of Commerce has imposed licensing requirements on 15 of the country's oil-linked entities whose revenues have contributed to the ongoing crisis in South Sudan. This means that all exports, re-exports, and transfers to these entities of any items originating in the United States will now require an export license. According to the World Bank, with oil revenue accounting for almost all of its exports and around 60% of its gross domestic product, South Sudan is the world's most oil-dependent country. Through this action, the United States hopes to increase pressure to end the country's five-year-old civil war and the resulting humanitarian crisis. In December 2013, less than 18 months after it declared its independence from Sudan, a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar spiraled into civil war. The continued fighting has cost the lives of tens of thousands of people and led to a devastated economy, human rights abuses, hunger, and malnutrition. One-third of the population has been displaced by the violence, nearly 2 million internally, and more than 2 million who have fled to neighboring countries. The 15 entities include South Sudan's Ministries of Mining and Petroleum and state oil firm Nile Petroleum. Also included are Dar Petroleum Operating Company, oil distributor Nayakek and Sons, Greater Pioneer Operating Company, Juba Petrotech Technical Services, and Sud Petroleum Operating Company. The listed entities are a source of substantial revenue for the government of South Sudan, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. Unfortunately, the South Sudanese government and corrupt official actors use this revenue to purchase weapons and fund irregular militias that undermine the peace, security, and stability of South Sudan, rather than support the welfare and current emergency food needs of the South Sudanese people. The government of South Sudan can do better, said Heather Nauert. As the largest donor of aid to South Sudan, the United States is proud to uphold humanitarian values and deliver vital assistance. The government of South Sudan must not squander that generosity and should take concrete steps to provide for the vast needs of the South Sudanese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.